You're listening to Radio Golf Show. Here we go. This episode of Radio Golf Show is entirely in English. I have always wanted to live where I could practice my golf shots in my pajamas before breakfast. Sounds like something Jack Nicholson or Bob Hope would say, doesn't it? But it is indeed a quotation attributed to golf architect Dr. Alistair McKenzie, who designed top courses such as Royal Melbourne, Cypress Point, and of course, Augusta National. Three golf courses our guest today knows and likes very well, I'm going to speculate. As a player, he won the Bing Crosby Open, which is now the AT&T, when Cypress Point was still in the rotation. He won the team event with Mark McCumber, 57 strokes ahead of our German team, and the individual trophy at the 1988 World Cup when it was played at Royal Melbourne. And, of course, he won two green jackets on Augusta National, including in 1995, when he did not record a single three-putt during the tournament. Coincidence? We think not. He always played well on good golf courses. Recipient of the USGA's highest honor, the Bob Jones Award, as well as the old Tom Morris Award and the Payne Stewart Award, he is also a member of the World Golf Hall of Fame. A four-time Ryder Cupper and the winning U.S. Ryder Cup captain in 1999. I'll never forget that press conference. He's an authority on golf history, and since 1986, he is a partner in the highly sought-after golf course design firm Kuhr and Crenshaw with his partner, Bill Kuhr. Ladies and gentlemen, meine Damen und Herren, we give you Mr. Ben Crenshaw. Ben, welcome to Radio Golf Show, sir.
Thank you, Frank. It's my pleasure to be on with you. When you were introducing me, my mind started going back to the lovely places that I've been able to play and study. And I do remember the times where I played well and came out on top. But I've had a wonderful life in golf. I had a wonderful father who was a good player. My dad was a lawyer. And a good athlete, but he started my brother, Charlie, and I was seven and he was eight. And we started knocking the ball around. And very, very soon after that, I met the most wonderful man, our teacher named Harvey Penick, who taught me literally everything about the game. I was part of a band of young golfers who just simply like to play, but we were introduced, I think, in the proper way, in that Harvey wanted us to go out and play our rounds, but he said, I want you boys to end up on the putting green, and I want you boys to putt against one another. And it started to making a game and competition out of that sort of aspect, and it stayed with me forever. I enjoyed putting. I was good at it, but I always think that competition in that nice form is a nice thing for kids to learn. I mean, it's born in all kids to want to go out and bash the ball, see how far they can hit it, but I soon learned as a teenager that the short game is half the game. Mm-hmm. And getting the ball in the hole when you're not hitting the ball well is part and parcel of how you can keep competing. My sort of admonition is that if you look every week in any form of competition, whether it's men's professional or ladies professional or juniors or amateurs, you can always look at the top finishers and they will have chipped and putted well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It mm-hmm. never changes. It never changes at all.
Right.
It's a way that you can retrieve good scores, and you have to have it in tournament play. There's no other way about it. I think if you look at Patrick Cantlay's win at the BMW this last week, he's one of the best putters I've seen in a good while, along with a great ball striker. But he hit some beautiful, lovely shots, little shots.
Mm-hmm.
Wedges and a wonderful bunker shot on the 17th hole, the next to the last hole.
Mm-hmm.
But his great, great two putt at the end there, a long putt up the hill, he almost made it.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of things, the touch that you have to have. No one's going to hit the ball so well all the time. It just never works out that way. But I enjoy watching the little shots as much as the big shots, let's say.
Right. Well, it's how Cam Smith won the Open with his putting, definitely.
Really?
But I heard you were so good in those little putting competitions that you actually had to call whether you would hit the left side of the little pin on the practice hole or the right side. Is that true?
Well, that's a little bit of a misnomer.
There we go. All right,
I'll say this. I would envision the ball going into the left or the right side.
There you go.
Every great putter I've ever seen,
mm-hmm.
Frank, is they have beautiful touch. And the ball arrives at the hole at a certain speed. And if you're lag putting, and if your concept of the putt, if that speed is in your mind and you can get it, then you can read putts. You know, it's one thing to aim right or left of the hole, but the ball has to have a certain speed.
Mm-hmm.
It's like our old teacher, Harvey Penick, said, give luck a chance.
Mm-hmm.
What he meant by that is have the ball die at the hole. I was a die putter.
Mm-hmm.
I played many rounds with Arnold Palmer and Tom Watson, and they were bold, very bold putters.
They would bash the ball
3 or 4 feet by. And that's a lot of stress coming back, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. There you go. Let's move a little bit into the golf course architecture, and I'd like to lead off with a question, maybe that is also has something to do with the current state of golf. What else is going on? And I'm just going to ask it straight out: is a shotgun start a slap in the face of every golf course architect?
A shotgun start?
Hmm.
Oh, I'll say this. It's funny. We're talking architecture and some people who've made an impression on me. The passing of Tom Weisskopf.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Weisskopf was a fascinating man. We talked for hours about the value of a short par four, which I think goes into today's review of how far people are hitting it.
Yep.
I know that he popularized the short par four for the modern day. There's a 17th hole of TPC Scottsdale where they play a tournament. But Tom always talked about the 12th hole at St. Andrews, which I think is a fascinating par four. It's one that you have to know. It's one that you can take liberties with. It's attainable in today's distances, but that green is fearsome. You know, if the wind is blowing and the green gets firm, Just a lovely plateau that runs across that green. And they put the pin up on top of that. And it's very beguiling, let's say. I think it's worth studying holes like that, which in great ways combat the vast distances, the way how people are hitting it. You know, it's one thing. I've always said it's an easy thing to make a hard, long, difficult golf course, but I think people's perceptions of that, it's a long, hard slog many times, and it only reaches a certain amount of people. One of the great aspects of St. Andrews is that anyone can play it.
Yeah,
anyone can play that golf course. There's a way around it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fascinating that to play it well, you really have to learn it. What the ball does when it strikes the ground, but there's avenues that you can take that you can get around it in a heavy wind, which, you know, in all fairness, there's not too many golf courses in the world that allow you to do that. I was fascinated by the play at St. Andrews this year. Obviously, Cameron Smith played fantastic, but I loved watching people get around that course. It's always, to me, has been a golf course where you envision what you're trying to do off the tee, and you think that you hit a good tee ball, and the ball ends up in a little pot bunker, and you start scratching your head and say, "Well, I forgot about this little guy here." It's just amazing. I think it may have been Bernard Darwin that said, "There's something about its very soul that outwits you," and it's, to me, it's still one of the great thinking golf courses in the world. There's so much to be learnt from St. Andrews, and to think that it was the original, and it's there, and to think there is such infinitesimal building of that course. You know, there's not much that in earthworks, I think the 17th green really was built, purposely built up, the road hole, that green. And then the 18th green was built up by old Tom Morris. But most of it is entirely natural, just as people found it.
You had a front row seat to that this year, didn't you, Mark?
Oh yes, I was very, very, very lucky. Actually, I was with Crail Golfing Society, and they send marshals to the Open Championship every time it's at the old course, and I was very, very fortunate to be on the 7th and the 12th hole while we're talking about short holes. There's not one word I wouldn't sign with my name. What you just said, it was fantastic. Also, the quality of play, how the players, even the young players, will acknowledge this course and see what it is, and the respect they really had even playing it, even though some of them were driving over the grandstands. You could see them on the practice day standing in knee-high rough, playing approach shots from where they intended to mishit their tee shots. And as you said, it's such a strong emphasis on the short game because, as you know, basically, if you choose the right tee, nearly everyone can get around the course. But it's also about hitting a good shot and then also being lucky. And, you know, and being able to wager your luck against the good shot or the bad shot, and just see how much the land itself plays the game there. You know, you really have to. I think that's what the winning guys did, or that were the guys who were really up to on top. They basically, I think, they give themselves over to the links to a certain degree and let the links play with them. And it's, I think Cam Smith basically partnered himself with the course to make that happen. It sounds a bit metaphysical what I'm saying, but I think you probably understand what I mean, is that you just, there's so much things you can't plan playing there.
No,
there's so much you really have to rely on happening. And it's a game about luck there too, isn't it?
Oh, no question. And it's when you really think of it too, in my terms, when I was first starting to read about these things, that, well, to me, Bobby Jones was, you know, he was the most literate man. And he always said that St. Andrews was his favorite course. And I always thought, well, I need to know more about this. And it occupied a lot of his thinking and his philosophy and his marrying with the philosophies of Dr. McKenzie. And it was a match made in heaven there.
Absolutely. Yes.
But they were extravagant admirers of the old course. And when you really, there's not enough that you can't learn about it. It's, but you do. In playing that course, you have to have a great amount of patience, because you can. You can get a nasty kick or you can get a fantastic kick. But where the ball can end up is a lot of it. And I'm always fascinated, especially when people are so enamored in this game with length. And it, you know, let's face it, it's unbelievable to watch players hit the ball as far as they do. So I never thought that we'd get to the point where almost the majority of the players can carry the ball 300 yards. It's just amazing to me. and then you start thinking about the conditions under which these fellows are tested. And it's usually the scores go up when things get a little firm and fast. And then it remains a little more elusive for them to play, a little more glassy, let's say. That's what it takes. If they ever get softer conditions, and then the scores plummet.
Yes. Yeah,
so it's I don't know.
But McKenzie also, Dr. McKenzie also, I mean, when he was designing in the Golden Age, what it was called, that was also a bifurcation in the road of the technology of the golf ball. So he was designing the courses with that modern ball in mind. How do you put that in your planning when you plan a golf course that is potentially a tournament golf course and a golf course everybody can play?
It's a great question, because I'd say most of our golf courses that we've built did not have a professional tournament in mind. I'd say 90% of our courses are meant to be enjoyed.
Yeah.
And so we have always tried to concentrate on everyone getting around. I that one admonition that, you know, in McKenzie's principles, that everyone should have a game regardless of what their handicap is. And you have to think about that. You must, you know, there's to avoid excessive carries from the tee box, let's say, and that's certainly one thing. And most of the times, frontal bunkering or frontal hazards that most people, you know, a lesser player has to carry. Well, I mean, that can be excessive, and that can be beyond people's capabilities, but you have to think about things like that. So our thinking and our philosophy in the review I've been so lucky to travel around the world, and the well-regarded courses, there's always a way in, let's say, in the entrance of the green, or let's say excessive carries, or because it combines interest for more people. And we think about that quite often. And we try not to have it beyond people's capabilities. So What I'm saying is that we had the Byron Nelson tournament in Dallas on a golf course that we did, and they did have the tournament there a couple of years. It was fun to watch people play it, but it was not meant to house the tournament. It was there for the members to play and their guests.
Right.
I can strongly relate to what you're saying, because I was extremely fortunate a few years back to visit Tasmania, and I was out with my son, who was 10 years old then, and we were lucky enough to play Lost Farm, Barnboogle. We had the most fantastic weather. It was benign, you know, there was hardly a wind, blue skies, father and son out on the course. He was playing from the front tees. And I've always tackled, I've always fought with my driving from the tee box. I've always been a loser of the ball to the left and to the right. But what I thought was spectacular and so much fun is that you gave us the possibility to bail out, to miss on the right, miss on the left, and still often have a shot into the green, making it more difficult, maybe, but there's always a way in. And we had the most enjoyable time. We played two rounds there, and in one day, and the little fella, I don't quite remember. I think he even beat me because his short game was just so natural, because he could see where the curve would be and where the ball would roll. So, and I've always thought your designs look like they're supposed to be fun. I think there's a fun element to them. There's something, and there's the ruggishness that will give you respect, but it's always, it does look like a game park. It's a place where you go to have fun and not to be beaten up. Though I'm sure if the wind blows in Tasmania, and it does blow there once in a while, you could get really beaten up and Lost Farm. But that was my impression, that you really used what was there, the land that was there, strong emphasis on short game, very tight lies around the greens. But fantastic place. And I'm really looking forward to getting there the next time. Probably take me another 20 years. I'll be old. I'll be playing from the front.
You'll be playing from the front.
I'll be playing at the back.
Mark, before...
Sorry. I just got carried away.
I enjoy playing from the front.
Mark, before we ask Ben why there aren't any Core Crenshaw courses in Europe or Germany or Europe, want to jump in the quick nine and do a couple of those? Because I know you've been... your time is... short. You have a very important golf game this afternoon in California, so we don't want to keep you from that.
Well, I have the feeling his wife might have to drag him from the computer. Okay, Ben, these are the quick nine. The quick nine are not quick. They've never been quick, and they're usually not nine. They're always more. It's like a golf course you designed. You say this is an 18-hole course, and you end up designing 22 holes because you just like the land. No, it's 20, isn't it? It's 20. Okay. Ben, your first ever golfing memory.
I had a little mashy, a 5-iron. That was my first club.
Yeah.
And I had a little blade putter that, oddly enough, the man who gave it to me was a Wimbledon doubles champion in Austin, Texas. He was the tennis coach at the University of Texas. I had those two little clubs. I had a mashie and a putter. Those were my first golfing memories. And then I would chip and putt. It's funny how I was seven years old.
Wow.
You were seven.
Started rolling the ball around.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, we'll just jump into the next one. These are, you know, these might feel unsatisfying, but I think our listeners like them. Yeah, because we could dwell on all these topics for ages. But okay, fantasy four ball. You can choose any player, dead or alive. Who would you like to play with, where, and why?
Oh, I always thought that I'd love to play with Bobby Jones. I never got to meet him. He died the year before I got to be, I was an amateur at Augusta, and I always wanted to meet him, and he died that preceding year. I would have loved to play with Bobby Jones, Dr. McKenzie, and I kind of loved to have met Harry Colt.
Oh yes.
I've studied in books so many courses that he did. He was outstanding. Uh-huh. Somebody who could build a course like Sunningdale is just, I mean, that's artistry and a love of golf and a real gift. I found him fascinating.
I'd tag along with that round.
Just probably, you know,
yeah. Where oh yes. Yeah, so where else? Where else? yeah. Okay. Something a bit less golf related. Golf has given you a tremendous amateur career, professional career, over 20 professional wins, 2 majors, and the opportunity to become, in my eyes, one of the most influential designers of the last decades. If it hadn't been golf, what would have you done with your life?
My father was a lawyer. He got his degree at Baylor Law School in Texas. He might have pushed me to the law. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if I was a good enough student for that at the time, though. he had many lawyer friends and involved in politics and business. It could have been that, but I'm just thankful for golf with the people that I've gotten to meet in this game. I've gotten to meet everybody of all persuasions in this game. It's given me my life and my not only playing, but education about what I thought that I wanted to do. From when I was in my playing days, I said I always wanted to be involved in building courses, and somehow it's happened. I have the most wonderful partnership with a guy. He means so much to me, Bill Coor.
Yeah.
It's ironic that Bill Coor and I and my wife, Julie, I married Julie 37 years ago, and Bill Coor and I had formed a partnership that year. So that year was a very gifted year in my life.
I believe it was 86, right?
That's right.
80, yeah, I mean, I found it fascinating when I read that you really got seriously involved in this golf course architecture in 86, and then you won the Masters in 95. I mean, you were in the prime of your playing career still. And you weren't just a guy who put his name on it. You were doing it. You know.
You know, I'll say this, that, you know, we had mentioned Tom Weisskopf earlier, but I had a connection with Jack Nicklaus, and I found it ironic that Jack was so involved in his architectural career when he was playing, still playing wonderful. That fascinated me, and so was Arnold Palmer. As an amateur, I started to travel a lot more, and I would go by a golf course that I'd heard or read about, and that was sort of my field study. And I found that a lot of fun. That was a hobby. And the more I learned about it, the more I wanted to get into business someday. So,
very cool.
Those fellows sort of got my thinking to a different path as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a great connection to the next question I have. Fourth question, I think it is. A good golf course should be 3 things. Please specify.
Number one, playable. Number two, I would say a natural appearance. In other words, the golf course should reflect that the land that it's on.
Yeah.
And I think probably the last one would be interest. Interest. Who was that wonderful, it was wonderful quote, should interest should supersede length every time.
Yeah.
I can't remember who said that, but that's always been a fascinating comment, and it's one that we think about quite a bit. A course should reflect its natural surroundings. I think that's a big part of it. We try very hard to try to pick a piece of land that's conducive to some of these elements that we've been talking about. We don't like to move a lot of dirt. You know, we're very, very old fashioned, very old school in that regard. We've turned down a few places where people have wanted us to build. We just look at it and go, that's too much work, and it won't reflect of what we'd like to do. There's so many people in this business who are so good at doing that. They can move large volumes of earth. But the trick is to move all that volume of earth and to make it look natural is a real engineering marvel. And some people are really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't go down that path.
Right. Well, if you look at some of the courses in the U.S. Open rotation, I mean, many of those courses were built before those heavy earth moving things even existed. You know, so
you're
it was
right.
Very difficult to, I mean, you know, I think, you know, all those old courses. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of Bethpage Black, where I, you know, played for many years, and at Tillinghast, and I had the honor to play Pine Valley once a year for a weekend. So, you know, those courses, they've withstood the test of time. You know, they're not built for resorts and things like this. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but.
They sure have. You know, the advent of the bulldozer, you know, and there was, you know, that the bulldozer was actually it started coming into Augusta National. They used a couple of dozers there. Perry Maxwell started to use them at Southern Hills and Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big fan of Perry Maxwell too. I grew up on a Perry Maxwell golf course in Austin, Texas. And he was, you know, later in partnership with Dr. McKenzie. I marvel at his work. Prairie Dunes is one of my favorite courses. And Crystal Downs in Michigan is a marvel. And that's a Perry Maxwell course and Dr. McKenzie. But of the architects that have been very influential to me in writing would be Dr. McKenzie, Donald Ross, Tillinghast, George Thomas
mm-hmm.
in our country, and Perry Maxwell. And Harry Colt. I mean, Harry Colt was a master.
Right.
As so many other, when you got the idea that golf architecture started going inland from the links courses, then it started to be people who started working with the earth more, and it opened it up considerably. But some of the greatest courses that have ever been built were fellows such as that started to work with the land.
Right.
Because as you said, you didn't have the machinery back then to do it.
Exactly. Exactly. Mark, number five.
Yeah, this is for the player.
Yeah.
You
got to talk about the player, Crenshaw.
Yeah, golf is a game of missed shots. The more one plays, the more one misses. Some missed shots stay with one forever, sometimes coming back to haunt. Looking back, is there one singular shot you would like to have a chance to replay?
Mark, there's plenty of them. I'll say this. The year that Seve Ballesteros won the Open Championship at Royal Lytham, I was close behind him. I double bogeyed the 71st hole. I hit a bad 2-iron my second shot and made a 6. A double bogey. Seve went on to win that. I don't know whether I could have made a difference. He was going to win. That was painful, really painful. Probably another one, though, is this, ironically, the same club, the 2-iron, at Medina at the U.S. Open in 1975. I double bogeyed the 71st hole and missed the playoff by one. It was the same darn two iron.
but in Seve's defense, he's the one who put your first green jacket on you, didn't he?
He did.
And then you put it on Bernhard. So there's a huge connection to Germany and Europe.
Bernhard, and then my second one, oddly enough, Jose Maria Olazabal.
And you gave it to Nick Faldo. We remember.
That's right. I have a special affinity for those fellas.
Absolutely, as you should.
All right, here's a quick bunch of questions, as short as possible. Lynx golf or Parkland?
Lynx.
Ride or walk?
It used to be walk.
So I'm going to skip the carry or push trolley one.
Do you drink beer on the course?
I don't.
You don't? You never alcohol on the course?
I never have alcohol. I've tried it a couple. I can't. I just go.
Oh, so you don't drink at all?
I do. Oh, yeah.
But not on the course.
Later on.
All right, okay.
Good on the course.
Yeah, I can't hit a ball even if I'm sober. So, I didn't even try drinking on the course. Okay, music on the range, one of our very favorite questions, people. Music on the range. Do you put music on when you're out there hitting balls?
Ironically, I don't. I love music, but I like to listen to it afterwards. But love people these days just love to blare music. I can't do it. I have to try to figure out what I'm doing wrong.
All right. I can relate to that. But if you listen to music at home, is it more classic or is it rock?
It's more, I'm more of a country Western fan.
Oh, excellent.
I got Waylon Jennings on my wall right here.
Right, okay.
I got to meet that guy one time. I got to meet Waylon Jennings. Of course,
and is he foursome?
I've known Willie for a long time.
Okay.
I mean, these guys are unbelievable. But
have you been out?
I love country music.
Yeah.
One of my current favorites is Eric Church. I love that guy. Oh, he's so good.
Have you been out to Willie Nelson's golf course?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He was great friends with our football coach, Daryl Royal.
Right.
And they played together forever. Ironically, our Austin Golf Club is within 2 miles of Willie's place out there. He has a 9-hole golf course.
Right.
And they have a little recording studio there.
Uh-huh. Very
cool. He's still playing. He's actually like 86 years old. He's in the game.
There you go.
I got another musical question for you.
Yeah, here we go. This is a big one.
Okay. This is one of Frank's favorites, actually. Yeah. You have won, I have been advised to say so, the Senior Club Championship. You and your friends decide to celebrate in a karaoke bar. Which song do you begin the night with, and which song is your last one?
Oh, wow. That is.
It's not really a golf question, but no, yeah.
Great question. I suppose my God, that's
maybe some Johnny Cash.
That's a good one. Could be a combination of Waylon and Willie.
Ooh.
God, that was such a great album. On the Road Again, I guess.
There we go.
Great one.
That was worth waiting for. Absolutely.
Yeah. That might be the start and the ending. oh. Might be the devil went down to Georgia.
Charlie Daniels. Oh my God, what I wouldn't give to see that.
I think we're going to have a party with all our guests, Frank. We're going to have to put up this karaoke box. And we're going to have everyone sing the songs they are. Ben, if you could play one more course for the rest of your life, which course would it be? I think I can guess the answer, but you might surprise me.
You know, it to me, it's a toss-up. It's a toss-up between St. Andrews and my own club, Austin Golf Club. Austin Golf Club was such a joy to put together. Austin was this growing population, and I had it in my mind. I would have loved to put together a golf club, no real estate. It's just a golf club, and it has happened. We started it in the early 90s, and we opened it in 1995. And it's a small membership. It's about 320 members, but everything, it's golf. No real estate, it's just golf. And it's really fun to play, and I'm so proud of it that people agreed to the idea, and it's been fun.
Frank, we're going to have to get an invitation.
Yeah, well, yes, I graduated from high school in Texas, so I've been to Austin.
And, you know the course. Okay.
I don't.
But you can drive us
you
there.
You guys are invited anytime. Oh, wow. We'd love to have you.
Oh, Ben, I have been waiting for this.
Mark has a much better memory than me, so be careful. Plus, he's younger. Ben,
if you could change one rule, what would it be?
Oh, you know, there's been so many changes in the rules in the last couple of years. I don't know what you can't do anymore. It's amazing.
That's a brilliant answer.
Well, you know, it used to be a long time ago that you teed up the ball and you hit it and you didn't touch it until you got it out of the hole. That's still pretty amazing. It's amazing how fast you can play that way. But all these gyrations that happens before a putt is hit is just amazing to me. I don't know what they're all doing.
Yeah.
The way that they line up the ball, they look at it, and they're straddling the line. I have no idea what they're looking for. It's like sometimes I look at them and I say, haven't they got a set of eyes? It's amazing to me.
There was a terrific final of the British Boys Championship just a week ago between two Swedish guys, two very good friends who we're going to have on the show next, who played 36 holes, and they were carrying their own bag, and they took maybe one practice swing, and they played, I mean, you know, and they played terrific golf. You know, I watched a little bit of the U.S. Amateur last weekend. There was a guy who looked at the hole 12 times before he took the club back. Very refreshing. I agree, even though I consider myself a slow player.
Everybody else does too. You are.
Mark.
Ben, do you sometimes dream of golf? And if yes, are they good or bad dreams?
I've dreamt about golf. I've dreamt about good and bad. There's no question. I find the bad ones are that I go to pieces, and I'm inept about anything that I do. Can't hit the ball. Can't putt. You know, something happens. It's a little nightmarish, I suppose. And then there's some happy dreams as well, but actually more often than not, I'll give you a hint. I always had two nightmares as a boy, and two. One of them was about snakes, and the other ones were tornadoes. I had these. I don't know why, because they're both prevalent in Texas.
Yeah, probably,
but. I had some kind of nightmares, and I'd wake up and I go, oh God, but I'd say more of my restless was about inept golf, not being able to do anything.
Yeah, not being the typical.
Suppose I'm human.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. And this is the last one, the not quick nine, because you already mentioned Harvey Pinnock, and you might not know, but he is one of the most read golf authors in Germany, because in the 90s, not a lot of German golf books existed, and there was a big boom, and they took his little red book and translated it into German, and a lot of people have read it, so he is quite a famous person. Mm-hmm. What's the best bit of golf advice you have ever received? Is there one singular tip that you would say that was something that took me through my career up until today, and I would give everyone?
I'll say this, that Harvey Pinnock taught us a lot more about life than golf. He was the kindest human being and most humble human being I've ever met in my life. His generosity and his kindness always stayed with us all the members, all the pupils, all the people who met Harvey came away with a special kindness that he had for, he absolutely, you know, he said it, he said, if you play golf, you're my friend. And it's a very simple way of, because he knew how good golf could be for all of us. He wanted to wanted people to be a gentleman and a lady about golf. He said it was an honor to play golf, and his humility just stuck with us all. When you learn from people like that, you only try to emulate as best you can, but you know you're going to fail. But honest to goodness, his spirit will always be with all the people. And I'm so glad that the German people got that book translated, because it is, there's a kernel of wisdom in it all, but it's something to hold on to. I must say that the author who put that book together, Bud Schrake, was a good friend of ours, and he, put together the right words in the right language and the right temperament that Harvey had. It was a work of art, that the way that he put that book together, and is, like you said, it's really one of the best selling sports books of all time.
Right.
Because it has more about it than golf.
Exactly. I mean, there was a terrific article in Sports Illustrated by Rick Riley after you won your second Masters, how your wife kept saying while you were playing, and you got maybe a lucky bounce or something, or a break, and she would, Rick Riley wrote in Sports Illustrated how she would say in the gallery, "Oh, there's Harvey." I thought it was a terrific article that Rick Riley wrote, and it certainly resonates with us here in Germany. A lot of things that you've done. I believe in fate, and I have a good feeling about tomorrow. I remember watching that on TV as a European. I knew that we were screwed for this. When I heard that, I saw your face, and I don't know if you were chewing gum or you had like some kind of sunflower seed in your mouth. I said, "Oh my God, he's serious." And sure enough, I mean, you know, we had five or six rookies, whatever, but so many things. I know Ben, and I know Ben, you have to. You have to leave for a golf game. I want to thank you very much for taking the time. Mark and I both hope that you'll come back. We'll talk about some of the things. And there's so many things to talk about, not just from the history, the architecture. I mean, you know, for it's interesting your point of view, why Greg Norman is picking a fight with Augusta and Fred Ridley, for example. Those are all things that are big topics that maybe we'll get another chance to talk about. My hope is that you had a good time, that you will come back, And don't burst our bubble today, but Mark, maybe we will be the talk at the next Masters Champions dinner.
When Mr. Langer,
have a little chat. Remember those guys?
My friend Bernhard Langer, we'll have to get together on that.
There you go.
By the way, I marvel at him.
Yeah.
What a golfer, and what a man. I thoroughly enjoy his friendship.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. And to me, it's amazing that he believes his best golf is still ahead of him. I think that's absolutely incredible. You know,
he has the strength right up here.
Yeah.
You know what? I think I even believe him. There's loads of good golf in that guy.
He's our athlete of the century. No question about it. No question.
Unbelievable.
Ben, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
We wish you a good day out in California.
And great seeing you and being with you. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, sir.
So did we, Ben. Thank you very much. It was fantastic.
You're welcome.
Good luck on the golf course today, this afternoon.
Thank you.
And
thank you
regards so to your wife, I can see in the mirror already.
She's waving at you. Yeah, for arranging the technology. All right.
Thank you, dear. Thank you. She just shut us off.
I think that was a mistake.
That was great. Okay. That was great.